Everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
Earth on the Air is bona fide, honest to God, public radio.
It's a bunch of different things.
It's definitely hands-on radio.
It's grassroots radio.
Grassroots radio. I mean, it's the entire plant, but it's mostly the roots.
It's looking at the connections between the environment and society.
It's Earth on the Air. In the next 30 minutes, a Seattle artist and environmentalist interviews African National Congress leader Chris Hani. Reflections on a new world order, and lots, lots more, contributed by people such as yourself. We'll start with a mosaic of thoughts about native activism.
It's dangerous for people to be both a little bit too generous and romantic about indigenous movements or any other movement. These are political movements.
That's Native Rights Attorney Russell Barsh. He's not an indigenous person, although he is a naturalized citizen of British Columbia's Mi'kmaq Nation, a tribe he represents in the United Nations. We'll check in with him periodically during this first part of our show. As we feature a couple of different tribal struggles, Barsh cautions us to see them as clearly and realistically as possible.
Indigenous people in any society, even in the United States, have many different backgrounds. There are good people and there are bad people. There are people with different religious training, with different class backgrounds, different economic interests. It's a world of very badly oppressed people, of people who have probably been the last to have their voices heeded in international politics, and who have had a great deal of their confidence and even their knowledge of their own institutions and their own virtues stripped away from them by colonialism.
And part of regaining confidence, Russell Barsh adds, is learning how to use the political process, which is a delicate issue for many natives these days because among their available tools, some of the most useful politically are their spirituality, their connection to the land. Now, you might think it's impossible for Indians to use these unique qualities for leverage without compromising them, but this is precisely the balancing act many tribes are attempting as they continue their fights for legal and political rights. Let's visit an unrecognized Washington tribe that's struggling against a regional power company's plans for expansion. Snoqualmie Falls. It's one of the most popular tourist spots in the state of Washington. If you've watched the TV show Twin Peaks, you've seen the crashing 268-foot cascades during opening credits. The site is also home to a hydroelectric power plant, and it's an historically sacred monument to the Snoqualmie Indians who live in the area. Drummers and singers from various tribes joined Snoqualmies recently in a call to a spirit gathering on a misty Saturday afternoon at the falls. It was a ceremony of spiritual affirmation and an attempt to raise public awareness about Puget Power and Light's plans to expand its hydroelectric plant there, diverting more water than it presently does. Ron Lazon is the Snoqualmie's tribal chair.
It's gone far enough. We felt that we had to come out at this point and try to stop the further encroachment on this area.
According to Puget Power, this protest comes somewhat as a surprise. The company says it's bent over backwards to accommodate the tribe and that the revamping of the falls will actually enhance the site.
We do have an aesthetic specialist who evaluates the aesthetics of a natural feature as opposed to a building or a highway.
Puget Power's Virginia Pistorisi.
And in evaluating this, they look at a whole variety of criteria, the plume, the mist, the width of the falls, how it plunges.
Pistorisi says her company may even be willing to increase the minimum allowable flows over the falls from what they are presently. But the Snoqualmies have been adamant. Tribal Vice Chair Art Fries.
There is no minimum, there is no maximum to religion. If you're going to preserve it, let's preserve it all. You don't take half of a church and cut it in half and destroy one half and say, okay, we'll leave the rest for posterity.
Free says the Snoqualmies would like to see the falls become an official spiritual and cultural landmark, thereby booting out the power plant altogether. But in dealing privately with Puget Power, the tribe has, until very recently, seemed willing to compromise. They're engaging in a complex blend of political strategy and spiritual beliefs. Natives had no say in the matter when Snoqualmie Falls was first used for hydroelectric purposes nearly a century ago. In recent years, however, they've been finding they do have a voice. But even a kindler, gentler electric company like Puget Power doesn't always know what to make of that voice.
Religions that the white race understands, you know, ours are a little bit different, but they are learning to respect these religions now, and this is one aspect of it. We want to have them realize this is our most sacred and religious area.
The Snoqualmies are struggling not just for their religious heritage, but for a political identity as well. Their approach to Snoqualmie Falls would probably be different if they were a tribe legally recognized by the federal government.
We're using or gaining public awareness for this issue, partly because we're not on the recognized list of the tribes.
If they were recognized, Puget Power would have to address them not merely as an interested party, but as a tribe, which would give them more leverage in seeking mitigation. An unrecognized tribe has to find creative ways of gaining political pull.
I don't know what it's like to be recognized. They have not offered me that status yet, so I have to go look at it from where I'm at.
The recognition process isn't easy. Tribes seeking legal status may need to demonstrate a documented history as well as a certain competence in working as a political force. This could be another reason the Snoqualmies are speaking out for the falls. Aren't natives culturally superior to all this game playing?
I mean, every ethnic movement that I've come into contact with in the UN wonders sometimes, its leaders wonder, whether they are all crazy or not.
Native rights attorney Russell Barsh.
Every movement produces a great deal of self-doubt and a great deal of self-criticism of the most brutal and unnerving kind. Because it's in the nature of moving against oppression that you are struggling to convince not only your oppressor but yourself that you don't deserve to be oppressed.
My name's Marilyn James, and I'm a member of the Sinayuks, or the Arrow Lakes people. Our original territory was from Revelstoke in British Columbia and went down to Walla Walla, Washington. The native people from that area were declared extinct in 1956 by the Crown and by the BC provincial government because we had been essentially ran out of the territory and absorbed by different bands. So what we're trying to do now is reestablish our reserve. We're trying to reestablish our land base. We are also, several of us have been directed by our hereditary chief and our council of elders to pursue getting back remains from Royal British Columbia Museum, in which we have gotten six remains returned.
Within every political movement that I've seen, not just indigenous ones, the leadership is always, always struggling with the question of whether its beliefs, its ideals, its goals are real, are justifiable, are they really there? Everyone's trying to grasp onto these things and say, yes, I know that's real. White people tell me it's crazy, but this is real. I know this is in my heart.
We're just now getting ourselves together in terms of what like-minded people coming together. We all know we're Arrow Lakes.
There are enormous amounts of energy expended in trying to define what the struggle is about. What do we really believe in? What do we stand on? What makes us different from everybody else? What gives us the right to fight back?
We're now got involved in getting the remains back, and we see that as really an important, very, we feel real responsible for that. And that's our number one goal at this point, is to get our people back and put them back in the ground. Other things will follow.
As it becomes more important, more people deeper down in the structure of indigenous communities are going to begin to say, hey, this is serious. I want to have my say.
Just like we have a responsibility to the earth, to the natural resources, we also have a responsibility to return to the earth when we die. And when archaeologists come and dig our remains up and put us in little jars and number our bones and take us out of the earth, they're deterring our responsibility to return to the earth.
Indigenous people are different because of the very obvious sense that they have. They are consumers of resources, but they're consuming resources a certain way. And that it is, in fact, their position in nature that they're trying to preserve, rather than to preserve nature separate from people.
We have an ability to live a sustainable lifestyle on this planet. And if we're all gone, all of the native people who can live a sustainable lifestyle are all gone, the rest of this people on this planet will not have a clue as to the interaction of the human species to the natural living environment. So I like to refer to Native people as the ultimate indicator species. We're the canary.
Still ahead on Earth on the Air, reflections on a new world order. But first, Susan Gleason, who works for a Seattle book publisher, and by the way, contributed that last interview with Marilyn James, got together with Scott Bergen, who's a computer programmer, to read a list. 12 Steps to Global Consciousness. You've heard of 12-step programs for various addictions. Well, here's one for those of us who are addicted to our Western lifestyles, designed to help us appreciate life in a third world country.
First, take the furniture out of your home. Leave a few old blankets, a kitchen table, maybe a wooden chair.
You've never had a bed, remember?
Second, throw out your clothes. Each person in the family may keep the oldest suit or dress, a shirt or blouse. The head of the family has the only pair of shoes.
Third, all kitchen appliances have vanished. Keep a box of matches, a small bag of flour, some sugar and salt, a handful of onions, and a dish of dried beans.
And rescue those moldy potatoes from the garbage can. That's tonight's meal.
Fourth, dismantle the bathroom. Shut off the running water, take out the wiring and the lights, and everything that runs by electricity.
Fifth, take away the house and move the family into the tool shed.
Sixth, by now all the other houses in the neighborhood have disappeared. Instead, there are shanties for the fortunate ones.
Seventh, cancel all the newspapers and magazines. Throw out the books. You won't miss them. You are now illiterate. One radio is now left for the whole shanty town.
Eighth, no more mail carrier, firefighter, government services. The two-classroom school is 3 miles away, but only two of your seven children attend anyway.
And they walk.
Ninth, no hospital, no doctor. The nearest clinic is now 10 miles away with a midwife in charge. You get there by bus or by bicycle, if you're lucky enough to have one.
Tenth, throw out your bank books, stock certificates, pension plans, insurance policies. You now have a net worth of $5.
11th, get out and start cultivating your 3 acres. Try hard to raise $300 in cash crops because your landlord wants 1/3 and your moneylender 10%.
12th, find some way for your children to bring in a little extra money so you have something to eat most days, but it won't be enough to keep you healthy.
So lop off 25 to 30 years of your life.
12 Steps to Global Consciousness appeared in Robert Heilbronner's book, The Great Ascent, as well as in Context magazine. Chris Haney is a leader in the African National Congress. Some say he's the logical successor to Nelson Mandela. He's an important guy. Well, he was touring the United States recently, trying to drum up support for continued sanctions against the South African government, when Kathy Bloom went to hear him speak. She's a Seattle-based environmentalist slash artist. After his speech, she got out her tape recorder and had a chat with Chris Haney.
When I went to interview ANC leader Chris Haney, I wondered what I might see in the face of a man born into infamous injustice, but who refuses to be a victim. Would there be violence in the eyes of a man who is a product of a violent system? I'd never met a revolutionary. He talked of the South African government's campaign to slander the ANC in the media. He spoke of strikes and walkouts and the dream of free elections, of economic turmoil, police brutality, and a slow turning of the tide. I wondered about the wisdom one gains from surviving a battle this long. I asked if he had hope.
Well, I've always been an optimist. I grew up in poverty, and I was surrounded by poor people all the time. I thought the biggest thing I could do in my life, the greatest thing I could do, was to make a small contribution towards a fundamental change in our society. Of course, I was inspired by great leaders throughout the world, by Fidel Castro, who led a small band in the fight against the Batista dictatorship. I was influenced by the great leader, Afro-American leader Martin Luther King, in the fight against racism in this country. I was influenced by the leaders in Mozambique, Angola. I was also influenced by the stalwarts of the ANC, men like Mandela, Tambo, Sisulu, Kwatane, who spent all their years in struggle, a struggle for the liberation of mankind from racist tyranny.
For a moment, I thought that good, politically correct, white, liberal guilt might require me to feel apologetic about not being born black in South Africa, about how safe my job is working as an environmentalist in Seattle. But things are the way they are. And I realized that Chris Hani wasn't interested in being more oppressed than thou. He was interested in justice. You might wonder what advice he had to give to all the planetary justice seekers.
Well, those fighters for social justice, for racial equality, and for environmental justice should know that the basic force in society for the transformation of society is the people themselves. Governments can never move if the people are not organized and ready to pressurize the government into responding correctly to the demands of the people. We can never achieve anything as individuals.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is Earth on the Air.
The adventures of Value Chicken.
But he doesn't have any feathers.
Don't touch that dial.
Today we find Value Chicken as he ventures out of his peaceful coop and enters the sprawling congestion of a modern city.
Okay, take a left on Garden Paradise, then another right on Eden Avenue. I know that laundromat is around here somewhere. Sorry about that. Where did those directions go? Oh well, I'll just take another left and... What am I doing on the bottom of the ocean? Well, life has given me lemons, but I'll just make lemonade.
Whoa, you there, the bird with no feathers.
Huh?
Stop your swimming and set yourself down by my campfire.
Well, all right. It isn't much of a fire, though, is it?
Yeah, well, you're not much of a chicken. You want some coffee? Gotta warn you, though. It's kind of watery.
I'm Value Chicken, partner. And my views don't necessarily represent those of this station.
Pleased to meet you, Value Chicken. Cowboy Pierre's the name.
Gee, Cowboy Pierre. I didn't know there were any cowboys on the ocean floor.
Well, where did you expect us to be? Near as I can tell, the West wasn't won. It was paved. Then I heard that the ocean was the last untapped frontier, and well, here I am. Kind of wet, though.
What do you do down here, oh Marlboro man of the saloons of Atlantis?
Oh, rustle the crabs a bit, round up the sea cucumbers. Yee-haw! come a herd of them wily cukes now!
Must be a great life. Well, except for the coffee.
I ain't got no complaints. Sure not like it was, though.
Why's that, old skull man of the briny deep?
Don't rightly know, but I think it has something to do with you.
Me?
All you people who ain't cowboys. First you stopped up the rivers, then you divvied up the land. Can't very well roam the range if you keep running into Burger Kings and cash machines.
But you still have the oceans. They're still wild and free.
That's what I thought, too, before I heard of drift nets and oil spills and something called sewage discharge. These days, the oceans are just a place to put all the garbage you don't got no more room for on land. See what I mean? Write a song about it, except my guitar already floated up to the surface. It's you and your kind that I feel sorry for.
Featherless chickens who have their own radio program?
Yeah, and everyone else up top, too.
Why?
You ain't got nowhere left to roam. With all your road maps and picture postcards, you ain't got no place left to discover. You done used up all the mystery in your saddlebags, but you still got a long, hard ride ahead of you.
Actually, my car doesn't have saddlebags. Cowboy Pierre? Why, he's gone. That music. Why, he isn't gone at all. Could it be that in each of us is a yearning to wander free, that Cowboy Pierre can be found in the depths of all of our hearts, and that by working together we can restore the world to the unspoiled frontier it once was?
No, actually, it was just me, a rare species of harmonica crab.
No, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's a common mistake, actually.
Well, yeah, but I mean...
No, really, I'm sorry.
And
I'm
so Value Chicken never does find the laundromat, but he does find something even more valuable. $30 million in sunken Spanish doubloons. But that's the subject of the next episode of...
Value Chicken.
Value Chicken is the creation of writers Tom Baer and Brent Hardinger. Next on Earth on the Air, bon vivant Jean-Paul Bardou is back stateside. You might remember he last sent us a report from where he was living in Denmark. Well, he submitted these thoughts to Earth on the Air about global weather.
Towards the beginning of 1984, I was riding my bicycle from Organ Pipe National Monument under a gorgeous Arizona sky. The desert was full of life. I turned back and saw a very dark line of ominous-looking clouds on the horizon. As time went on, I could see that the clouds were getting closer at an alarming pace. I foolishly tried to race ahead of them, but they easily caught up to me. Within seconds, the storm drenched me. The roadway turned into a pool as huge drops loudly impacted on the ground all around me. It was a quick, powerful, and salutary event. Minutes later, it was gone, and the grateful desert was rich with wet scents. My second experience of a desert storm took place at a distance towards the beginning of the year 1991. That one was not quick, for it dragged for far too long. It was not powerful, but overpowering. Neither was it salutary, for it destroyed a whole country, killed more than 100,000 people, many of them innocents, and started a socio-ecological disaster. So nowadays, when I think of a desert storm, I'd rather let my mind drift back to Arizona and the beautiful experience I had there.
Remember Vietnam for 20 years?
No.
Right, and we forget.
Okay, I liked it, but it makes me wonder why now. Like, you would need a reason. The piece, it needs a hook.
Well, it's a piece about remembrance, so there is no time for it. You know, right after the war, everyone's on their victory high, and now the country is starting to come down off of it. So now is the time to examine how we're going to remember this war and what we should think about it and what should stick in our minds.
It's the same picture throughout Iraq. In the south, too, Allied bombing followed by civil clashes have left cities devastated. Water, sewage, electricity supplies have been severely disrupted, leading to the rapid spread of disease. but hospitals now more overworked than ever and near to collapse both physically and medically.
Yeah, it was scary over there. I was a little frightened, well, I was a lot frightened about going over to Saudi and not coming back and wondering about how it was going to affect me. And now that it's over with, I feel like I came through with flying colors. So it's like on to the next challenge.
What a great country.
I guess the reason, like I said, I joined was for the discipline. You know, I felt as though I needed some structure.
What a great country. I learned that I'm capable of doing a lot of things that I never thought I'd be able to do.
It was a trip because I flew into Germany after I left Saudi, and they had a little TV thing set up. And my first image, the first image that I saw after leaving Saudi Arabia was the police beating the hell out of Rodney King in L.A.
What a great country. And I started feeling sorry for myself. Well, they're paying all this attention to people over there, and I was over there. I wish I was back over there so that they could pay attention to me again. Now that I'm back, they don't know that I was over there, and so I'm just part of society again.
What do you think of the new world order?
I think it's the same old order.
What do you think the new world order is?
The capitalist boys that want to keep playing.
What do you think the new world order is?
Undeterred U.S. aggression.
What do you think of the new world order?
Well, that's the same question I've been asking. I don't know what the new world order is. Maybe you can tell me.
It's an artificial invention meant to disguise our own domestic problems in order to further our artificial dominance in the world. What do you think of the new world order?
I don't know.
I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is.
What do you think of the new world order?
Well, I'd like to know what the new order consists of. If it's peace, I'd be happy with it, but I think what it really means is more United States hegemony over the entire third world. That's what it really means.
I think peace is like a faraway land, and you have to hike to it, and it's a great hike to get to it.
Well, I think that peace has a lot of things to do with nature, and the big subjects coming up are the rainforests and recycling issues, and if we don't start with nature and natural things, then we're not going to get anywhere with world peace, because we need to have a world to have peace in.
I think that if we were to have peace, we would have to get all the poor people, the homeless people, to have homes and not be poor anymore, and everybody have a good life.
A lot of people, and I always wondered this too, why we are on this world. Why we're on this earth. I think it's to accomplish peace, and I think when we do accomplish it, it'll be very nice.
The radio term for a collage of different voices is vox pops, vox populi, voice of the people. Those last vox pops of the kids were submitted by Roy Goodman, who's an office manager in Seattle. Before that, you heard music by independent Rick Wolf with vox pops on the New World Order by schoolteacher Dave Fisher. That's our program. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, it's your show, too. We appreciate your comments, and even more, we appreciate your participation. You can write us for tape submission guidelines at Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. That's Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle, 98145. We'd be happy to work with you. We had additional help from Craig McDonald, Bill Svoboda, Rob Becker, Ted Jessen, Laurel Grady, and Janice Kane. Original music was contributed by David Hines, Carol Ann Stockton, and Randy. Our show was produced in Seattle with the help of Jack Straw Productions, KCMU-FM, and KSER-FM in Linwood. Partial funding was by the New Roadmap Foundation. For Earth on the Air, I'm Peter Mayloff. Down, down.